This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, we have Panky Tek to help us in that endeavor. He's freshly returned from an MA in Gender, Sexuality and Culture. That's the name of a course that he attended at Birkbeck College in London. And what is it that we're going to be talking about today? None other than Michel Foucault and his work, The History of Sexuality, Volume 1. Now, what is clear is that this is not a work in the classic study of sex, right? That, say, someone like Havelock Ellis and the like during the 19th century. So what is it that, before we get into the question of who Michel Foucault is, what kind of study is this?
Well, I mean, Havelock Ellis and people like them were doing work about sexology. I mean, they were the early researchers on sex, and they came up with the idea of, that we now know as sexology, which is, you know, the very early studies of how sexuality became identity and formed a kind of subjectivity. Foucault actually kind of deconstructs those ideas and says that, I mean, he basically looked at how the idea of sexual identity was actually a product of medical and juridical discourses of its time.
So it's a remove from the question of sexual practice and cultural and social norms regarding sex, right? So it's not that, right?
It is kind of looking at governmentality and the government's a way of disciplining bodies through creating a language that will describe aberrant and deviant sexualities.
Right. So, I mean, it's already we have quite a number of terms there, like governmentality and all that, which Foucault, in some ways, gives a new meaning to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fuad, I mean, were you ever interested in Foucault?
Yeah, he was mandatory reading for any critical theory course you take at grad school in the West. And he's largely known for doing what Pang said, throwing a wrench into the taken-for-granted assumptions people have about sexuality as being, you know, inalienable or inherent to us. And what he shows is that, like Pang said, it's a product of discourse and a kind of social pressures manifested in the way we classify things. And it is out of that circumstance that identities are shaped, rather than it being natural or, you know, in the liberal discourse of, you know, whether it's a choice and all that. Those things Foucault would show in this book are kind of misguided ways of looking at sexuality.
So now when we talk about discourse, because that's another one of those terms that needs to be explained a little, right? We're not talking simply about the talk around or the rhetoric around sex and sexuality, are we? There's something else at stake when we talk about discourse. I mean, what is that, Pang?
So one of his earlier premises in the book is actually about how people who were propagating the sexual revolution of the 50s and the 60s, particularly from the Marxists and the left, were saying that sexuality has been repressed, right? That they were emerging from the Victorian era where there was a lot of repression of sexuality. And Foucault's hypothesis is actually that there is no repression. In fact, that during the Victorian era, there was what he called an incitement to discourse. In other words, the study of sexuality, the giving of names to different types of sexual behavior and therefore also sexual categories, right, of people, gave rise to different ways of talking about sexuality. And so there was actually a lot of discourse around sexuality rather than a repression of sexuality.
So what does this discourse lead to? Because it seems to me that Foucault was trying to show that discourse creates a certain kind of outlook, creates a certain kind of relationship between people. What is the impact of discourse?
I think his point was that this language was a product of the medical field of its time, actually taking over from a kind of the moral field that was left by the church, right? You know, in the West, that created the idea of the pervert and the deviants, right? So the medical practitioners of its time took to studying where did these aberrations, sexual aberrations, come from, right? And the interest in the states, or rather the state's interest in, therefore, looking, using the medical discourses to find where the aberration is actually, according to Foucault, a way of disciplining the population, of creating a responsible, productive, or rather reproductive population.
The word discipline, of course, is something we associate with Foucault as well, and in his study of the prison and what they call total institutions, you know,
like
prisons and hostels and, you
ships.
Know, and yeah, anywhere where there is kind of a control of your life from the start of the day to the end and such. What is it that we need to know about the use of the word discipline in this context?
My understanding of discipline is that it's not merely discipline in the way that we understand it as this kind of external power controlling us. It's how certain regimes of truth constructs identities. And we internalize these identities thinking that we have a direct knowledge of it, when it's actually, it comes out of, like Pang said, discourses, you know, the way in which categories are attached to us. So discipline here is not merely control, but also a construction of subjectivities in the process.
Isn't it also a question of a kind of the level of abstraction that you're talking about? You can be talking about large populations and disciplining populations, and you can also be talking about the individual. Is Foucault primarily concerned about the level in which these discourses operate for individuals, or is he looking at large populations and certain patterns of behavior at that level?
From what it appears to me anyway, Foucault's interest is definitely more to do with population and government. And he has a tendency, and this has been critiqued, to describe power as a monolithic force. Yeah, I mean, like there's, you know, so he looks at government, he looks at power, you know, as if they are a block that operates on populations through a very vertical relationship. So where a lot of future scholars have taken Foucault is actually to then look at how individuals negotiate these powers and actually perform what they see is their relationship with power. And so sometimes it's hard to tell whether people are performing these powers or they're internalizing these powers. And that's where the Foucault's notion of discipline breaks down as well, which in very interesting ways. Yeah.
In terms of the work itself, what is Foucault's methodology? I mean, what kind of text is he reading? Is he a sociologist that's going around asking questions of individuals? Is he doing surveys? How does he derive his sense of this these regimes of knowledge and power?
Actually, this is where Foucault has been really heavily critiqued, right? Because while he's a very powerful thinker, he has been also known to make incredible generalizations, you know, based on some scant evidence that he's found. However, some of his evidence are very persuasive. For example, when he talked about how in the absence of discourses, in the absence of actually records that deal with sexuality, sometimes you can look at where silence proliferates. So he reads silences in very interesting ways. You know, for example, he looks at one example was how a boarding school was designed and how the corridors and the rooms are particularly designed in a way to allow the schoolmasters, you know, ways of watching and therefore disciplining young boys in their with their raging hormones and all that. Yeah, so he's saying that sometimes these things are not necessarily silence, but they're just that the discourse operates on at different levels through the sites of the discourse itself.
So yeah. In this case, architecture and space.
Yes, yeah.
I want to ask about the repressive hypothesis that he starts his analysis with. And what I've always wondered is what happens to it after the conclusion is made, in that, of course, he describes how discourse creates these new categories of deviant sexual behavior, so on and so forth. But doesn't the gay rights cause nonetheless, does it not make it more necessary, given that he is showing that there is, in fact, a very deep-seated regime of policing sexuality that exists.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I found very interesting is because I have come from background of, you know, of activism, right, where I've stood on platforms that champion rights based on sexual identities of, you know, the L, the G, the B, and the T's, right? So, there's I used to operate through this assumption that these are stable categories and identities that through which therefore you must claim your right to be. And encountering Foucault is quite challenging because it kind of destabilized all these assumptions that I had. And how I engage with it is it's just actually I've been very liberated by this notion that, you know, that these identities came have a historical point. In fact, what he's trying to say is that sexual identities are historically produced. I mean, they were produced through a certain particular context, you know, particular discourse at that moment when the state, particularly the empire, was panicking about its contact with its colonies, right? So, and this was, of course, this study has been done through Anne Laura Stoller in the America, you know, whose analysis of Foucault's history of sexuality shows that actually there's a description about how when the empire comes into contact with its colonies and then more and more of the Western colonizers in these colonies are starting to fraternize with the natives, you know, and getting and reproducing, therefore, mixed children. But because they are also the children of colonizers, they then have access to administrative posts and things like that, and thereby could endanger the empire's role in managing these colonies. Right, so the empire needed to regulate this fraternizing, this contact, and all that, and therefore produce, you know, start to police who you can fraternize with, and start to produce a lot of discourse around who you can have sex with, and how sex should be done, and when you should do it, and this by nature then also looked at how what is good sex and what is bad sex, you know, and gave us this whole plethora of actually at that moment a lot, including homosexuality. There was also bestiality and
Pederasty, was it?
Yeah, pederasty and a few others, a few other categories. Basically, the Foucault's theory was that before that, the sodomite, right, was the category that was often used, right? And sodomite suggests that you are a person who performs sodomy. In other words, it was based on your behavior and your action. As a result of the medical discourses that led to the creation of the idea of sexual identity, homosexuals become a species. Yeah, and therefore Foucault's challenge was that by championing the rights of the homosexual to his identity, we are reproducing the power that has first created this species to subjugate it.
Now, this is something actually worth sort of exploring a little further, the difference between the act and this kind of essentialized characteristic, right? Something that is inside of you. And because I think it might not be clear to people the difference. And, you know, for instance, the difference between, say, the act of, I mean, you mentioned sodomy, which is anal sex, basically.
Yeah.
Or and saying, well, we outlaw or criminalize anal sex, whether it's between men or between men and women, and saying we criminalize being gay.
Right.
So the identity of being gay. And so in the Malaysian context, being gay is not a crime.
Right.
Whereas the act or particular acts, and whether it's got to do with fellatio and which is oral sex and anal sex, are the criminalized acts. And then when we get to the more difficult question of what is the politics of that? You know, is it better to actually accept a regime of knowledge based on something like an essential character, because that's exactly how identities are built. Identity politics is all about some essence, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
As opposed to just a series of acts. So we'll come back to this in the next section. You've been listening to Punky Thick. He's freshly returned from an MA in Gender and Sexuality and Cultural Studies at Birkbeck College. And he's talking about Michel Foucault's work, The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. I'm Sharad Kutan on Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome back to Night School. We're talking about the work of Michel Foucault and his influential text, The History of Sexuality, Volume 1. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, Panky Tech is leading the discussion. He's freshly returned from an MA at Birkbeck College, and the course was Gender, Sexuality, and Culture. Now, Pang, we were talking about the distinction between the act and the essence, and, you know, what politics, as it were, is produced by that distinction. And you were saying that in some ways Foucault critiques this of the taking up of that category of, say, sexuality as an essence, as something that's essential to your identity, yeah, as problematic.
Basically, I think Foucault's engagement with this idea has been that there is an assumption after Freud, right, that sexuality is a force within us that cannot be repressed, right? And that the repressing of it results in this force being uncontainable and therefore becomes necessary for people to express. And sometimes so much repression then results in what becomes popularly described as perversion. So all these perverted acts are a result of a repression of a very natural force. But Foucault's engagement has been that this force that is assumed to be natural within us is actually a product of medical and juridical discourses, or rather, I mean, when I say juridical, I mean legal language of the time, right, that has produced the idea of sexuality as an identity.
So based on what you describe what Foucault said, is there a subject to be liberated?
Precisely. I mean, he's saying that what needs to be liberated is to defy the category itself. Right. Actually, he did not say it in so many words. He never actually proposed a method for activism, but he is simply suggesting that the methods through which the people who are propagating the sexual revolution are suggesting is misguided, because they are basically, what he believes, propagating a discourse that has been used to subjugate them. In other words, the medical category itself. The medical category already has embedded the forms of power that has been used to subjugate them. And what is very interesting in Foucault's formulation has been his notion that every resistance already always reproduces the forces that is repressing it. Yeah, every resistance reproduces the forces that represses it, because sometimes it borrows the language uncritically. So by using the sexual identity, we are actually trapping ourselves within this notion of an identity that needs to be claimed before we can have access to the rights and the freedom.
I'm just sitting here and listening. I mean, this is fascinating stuff, and stuff that I studied at university as well. But it presumes a particular understanding of subjectivity and the subject, right?
Right.
And you know, when you say, oh, you know, medical discourses, you know, I can imagine a lot of people saying to themselves, well, actually, medicine's about curing you and disease, and it's about medication, it's about understanding the anatomy and how, you know, and physiology and how things operate. And you know, so the idea that there's something called a medical, juridical, I mean, these are big words, discourse that is produced by something, as we think, is pretty innocent. It's a hospital, right? That somehow shapes us as beings is something that really needs to be explored.
Can I explain then? I mean, actually, another scholar has done a better job explaining that moment that Foucault talked about, but was very general about. So Arnold Davidson has this few series of very powerful essays in which he looked at how the doctors, and particularly the early psychologists, looked at and produced the idea of sexuality as identities. Basically, the very early doctors were looking for an aberration of the genitals, right, to explain sexual aberration. I mean, you know, because that in the past, the idea was that if you are ill, right, what you are, the organ that is ill will exhibit the symptom is exhibited through that organ, and therefore the lesions or the breakdown must be in that organ itself. So there was the assumption that if, of course, you know, if your problem is sexuality, then the problem must be in the sexual organ. But of course, they couldn't find anything in the sexual organ that was different of the people who participated in sodomy, bestiality, and all that, right? So then that moment also started converge with the rise of psychology as a form of study, because I think that led very quickly from the notion of through the liberal philosophy, right, of the inner subjectivity of a person being the essence of who he is, right, that who you think inside you and that private space of yours in that brain is who you are, and therefore your external behavior must conform to who you think you are inside you. I mean, this is very much an extension of liberal philosophy at the time. Mm-hmm. And so psychologists took that notion and went with it and therefore started looking for lesions in the brain, right? But yet again, they couldn't find any lesions in the brain of perverts, so to speak. And at that time, if they had, according to Arnold Davidson, if they had realized then there's no lesion in the genitals, there are no lesions in the brain, maybe there's nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is not a pathology at all. But they wouldn't let it up because they've already moved in that direction, right? So the momentum was created that led them to the next conclusion, which is the lesion, or so to speak, the lesion is in the mind.
Mm. Okay, so now we get into the space of metaphor, because we've gone from the physical lesions on physical structures of the body or the brain to something like a psychological lesion.
That's mm-hmm. right. So in other words, it's the subjectivity that has a problem right now. Yeah.
Yeah, but it comes out, I think the interesting point I took from Pang's description is that it comes out of a particularly liberal notion of the individual, right? And I think the larger lesson that we can point to for your initial concern about, you know, how we can really relate to these claims of juridical medical regimes of truth is that medicine is never ahistorical or apolitical. You know,
yes,
and I think that's where we make the mistake when we think that the hospital is just a hospital, right? But we have to look further and see, you know, what discourses they sustain.
And so what is very interesting is to look at, therefore, how sexuality itself was historically contingent. The idea of it because of sexuality emerging as a form of identity was historically produced through a certain context, through the empire's anxiety in its contact with its colonies, through the rise of capitalism and the need to use the family unit as a space to reproduce the next generation of workers, and also, you know, things like that. So there, all these moments came together very beautifully to create or make it possible to believe that sexuality is an identity.
I mean, what is interesting about somebody like Foucault is that he provides us a new entry point into actually materials that are already existing, right? And so then if you read Foucault and you're a historian, you can go back and you can look at your material and rethink it, because what he gives you is a different foundation on which to build an understanding or interpretation of your material. Basically, you say, well, what are the conditions that make possible this modern subjectivity that we call the individual, or the normal person or the abnormal person? And because of that, you can now write a history that is not simply about one event following another,
right,
or a greater progress in terms of understanding disease, but really this other thing that's happening together with that progress. We take nothing from that progress. We don't, in fact, reduce medicine to these discourses. But along with that is inadvertently, sometimes unintentionally, the production of these new subjectivities. Now, where do we go with that understanding once it's laid out? And is it, in fact, uncontroversial that our subjectivities are the product of these medical and legal institutions and discourses? Where do we go?
One very interesting example in the past few years, at least, of how this notion of sexuality, or rather sexual identity, being something that is not ahistorical and not consistent across all cultures and geographies, right? Because ultimately, that's what Foucault is saying, right? That that homosexuality is something that was produced in the late 19th century through psychology. So it was contingent upon that time and upon that culture and that context. So the recent engagement with that has been, for example, an activist called Scott Long critiquing Western gay rights activists and how they're trying to save gays in other countries where those cultures and contexts do not have such an identity as gays or do not look at sexual behaviors through the lens of it as an identity.
But, you know, somebody might say, well, you know, the question of the homosexual is actually older than the 19th century, that, you know, one has only to look at biblical sources to see. And so is the sodomite of the Old Testament the same as the homosexual of the 19th century? I mean, somebody might say yes.
This is still a very productive debate right now, because I think some people have managed to say that, yes, there's an evolution of subjectivities, you know, that therefore the historically we can see that the early sodomites, or even, for example, the people who gathered in what they were called the molly houses. In other words, they were like gathering spaces in UK for sodomites and catamites. Catamites are people who receive. So such spaces create a subculture through which the people who gather there form a kind of identities, you see. So it's not fair, I guess, then to deny their subjectivity and say that they do not see their acts as forming a form of identity. But what that identity is yet to be determined, you see, or whether they actually see it as inherent in who they are, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, as a form of, to be called a homosexual.
A different subjectivities, in other words. Even though the experiences might overlap, the expression, the way they relate to themselves as subjects, as agents, be different.
Yeah. Even in the phrase now, so some people try to be very neutral and use the phrase like same-sex attraction in order to avoid describing somebody as homosexual. But then the phrase same-sex attraction assumes that the attraction is on the gender. Right, that, you know, that in the past, for example, that when a man is attracted to let's say a young boy, we're looking at the Greek times, right? Yeah, there's an assumption that the attraction is the gender, or the sex, but it could be maybe the attraction was operating through the lines of power or class of, you know, free and unfree man. So those things form the basis for people's attractions as well, you see. And the phrase same-sex attraction sometimes do not, or rather they mask this context.
I mean, this complicates the sexual rights agenda. I mean, I think you were alluding to that earlier. So in what way does it become more difficult to be a sexual rights activist in a globalizing world?
It is very challenging if you take on this notion, right? Because as I was pointing out, the activist Scott Long, the scholar activist Scott Long, when he was, for example, critiquing Peter Tatchell, who is a leading gay rights activist in UK, and his attempts at saving gay teenagers in Iran, you know, from being executed by the state. Because the premise is that Scott Long is saying, in some instances when Western gay rights organizations receive news that Iran has put some teenagers on the death row for the crimes of sodomy, and then quickly these Western gay rights activists come in and say, you know, these gay boys are being executed by the state and we should fight against the states that do this, right? Sometimes this has led to the states actually expediting the execution, because now there's someone saying, oh, these boys are gay, and in Iran, to be gay is, you know, a crime, right? So, whereas before this, their crime was sodomy, and maybe there's a way, their lawyers could have found no evidence for that crime, and then, you know, the case would probably fade away. But now somebody's coming along and say, these boys are gay, thereby actually damning them further, you know? So in other words, actually a lot of critique now is about the cultural insensitivity of the context by activists internationally, which then leaves us with the problem, right? How then? What then? What platform do we use if not on identity?
So Pang, maybe thank you for this really fascinating discussion. Maybe in summary, you could tell us your thoughts on this tension between, you know, the universal and particular forms of pleasure. and identity. What you've studied this stuff. What are the conclusions you've encountered?
My conclusions is that the people are still debating it. And no, really, I think I must admit that, you know, it has troubled me a little to be left without some of the platforms upon which I used to activate. However, I think what it has liberated me to as well is to trust that actually on some level, people don't always need a stable identity to achieve their desires or find access to the, you know, to the freedom. In fact, sometimes by performing certain other identities or the scripts or the norms of those identities, wherever they are, allow them some freedom to access their desires in privacy. And actually, in many ways, people have already, you know, found ways to fulfill their private desires, regardless of the identities they adopt. And one of the violence I think that we're in danger of doing is to always insist that people adopt a certain identity before they can access those rights. And I think there's a lot more agency that people have demonstrated through the way they grapple and the way they pursue their desires. And I'm talking about both, actually, even desires for intimacy as well as desires for sociality, you know, and how we negotiate with all these different desires have a lot more fluidity, a lot more destabilizing constructs within them itself, yeah, that sometimes, of course, distresses us, but also liberates us at the same time.
You know, if I could have like a last word, I think that's naive, though, because when you look at the nation state and what it demands in terms of protecting rights, you might actually think of a strategic utilization of these stable categories and essentialized identities in order to advance a cause, especially one that perhaps doesn't limit you, but at least provides some core principles of the nation state in dealing with different populations. And that kind of strategic use of essentializing identities is not something I would discount immediately, precisely because of the nature of the nation state as it exists now.
I think that leads us very nicely into the following discussion on citizenship, you know, and how it...
But that will have to be for another week, yeah, Pang. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, you can ask Pang more questions on the issue of Foucault and the text that we've been discussing today, or use as the basis of our discussion today. That's The History of Sexuality, Volume 1 by Michel Foucault. Pang, do you tweet and are you on Facebook?
Yes.
So he does both. What's your handle?
Pang Khee Teck.
That's at PangKheeTeik. And you can always engage with Pang on our Facebook page.
Actually, I feel a need to respond to your last statement. Very quickly, though. I'm aware of the certain naivete that is embedded in completely rejecting identities, right? You know, and so actually my... I have no answer at the moment, but I am also willing to actually say that right now, where we are, we have a kind of multiplicity, you know, a proliferation of different ways of being and different ways of achieving what we want in our lives, right? That some people have access to through identities, and some people have access to by performing acceptable identities, and then... you know, then pursuing what may seem unacceptable socially, privately. So I think there are many ways of engaging and pursuing what you want, sometimes through identities and sometimes without identities. And I think we must find a language that can allow both to express themselves.
So you can engage with Pang on Facebook. In fact, you can even write to him via our Gmail account. That's bfmnightschool@gmail.com or engage with him on Twitter. My handle is at Sharad Kutin. Fuad is still outside the discourse of the Twitter world.
Although I should let our listeners know that Pang will be making an appearance for BFM Night School Live, our second installment, alongside myself and two other regular guests to talk about human rights, the limits of human rights. And that will be on the 15th of December at noon at Annex Gallery at Central Market.
That's a Sunday?
That's a Sunday, yeah.
Right. Thank you so much, Pang, for being here. You were listening to Punky Tech. Ahmad Fuad Rahman and myself, Sharad Kutan, on Night School, BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.